Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Delve into those difficult moments with some well-known guests. I'm Giles Paley-Phillips, and with me is Jim Daly.
Hello to you. How are you doing?
Well, apart from being tongue-tied, I'm all right, actually. Thank you.
Good. What have you been up to recently? What is it? We're end of August now. We're still in lockdown, sort of. What have you guys been up to?
Well, I had a bit of time off last week. Which I hadn't taken any sort of time off really from working over the entire lockdown. Well, pretty much since March, really. So it was nice to have a few days off, and we took the kids out a few days out. We're not going away this year, so just a few day trips really, which was very nice. Mm. And obviously the weather was really hot as well. That really hot bout of weather, and there was a few days where we just sort of sat in the garden under shade and the kids played in the paddling pool. So it was nice. What about you?
We've done the exact same thing. Mm. Actually, it's closest we're going to get to holiday, I think, this year, sitting in the garden. It almost felt like the holiday weather, actually. So it was, we haven't gone away either. I think I know a lot of people have sort of done staycations and stuff, and it's a weird one for that, isn't it? But I think, I think this ties in with our guest today, which is obviously the amazing Ronnie O'Sullivan. Mm. But this year, 2020, is about just sort of like sticking at it, getting through it, cracking on, and not worrying too much, I think. And actually, that ends up being a big theme with this episode of Ronnie, with his career in total, actually, and also his advice to sort of younger players. It's like, stay in the game, don't let the emotions of snooker get to you too much, and sort of keep going. And actually, a lot of what he says when he's talking about, he talks about his sort of psychological work in snooker and how he's been improving on that. So much of it can be related to life in general. There's a lot of really interesting bits of advice here that I think we could all use.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Ronnie is a legend of the sport. I mean, he has been 6 times world snooker champion and won obviously countless other masters and UK titles and all sorts of tournaments, and he's still number 2 in the world. And and obviously he's always been quite an outspoken player on the tournament, and obviously recently it caused a bit of controversy with some of his comments about the younger players and stuff. But I think, as we talked to him on the podcast about, it was almost like his way of lighting a fire under, and I think I said that on the podcast, lighting a fire under some of those younger players to start trying to compete more with those sort of more, the sort of legends and the sort of titans of the game that are still around.
It'd be amazing, actually, to do, if we could do an episode in like 20 years' time, one of these younger players, and they've like won loads of world titles, and they're like, it was when Ronnie had a pop at me in 2020, and it fueled me. So this, I mean, he's arguably the greatest sportsman of all time when you think about how long he's been at the top. But what's lovely about this episode, and I'm sure it will come across early doors, is just such a nice guy. He's just so down to earth and lovely. Yeah. And we spent a bit of time chatting to him before and afterwards and helping him sort of upload through WeTransfer and stuff. And just really nice, welcoming, open, and just it was just a really, really lovely guy, and I hope that comes across, because it was such a nice, easy chat with him for an hour and a half.
Totally down to earth, and really you what you see is what you get with Ronnie, and I think that's why people like him so much. He's his outspokenness is not being outspoken, it's just being honest. I think, outspoken can sound like it's a negative thing, but he's just being honest. Yeah. And he was very honest with us on the podcast, so it was a real privilege to sit and talk to him for over an hour, which was lovely. And really nice guy, and we're hopefully going to catch up with him and learn to play some
Kaluki.
Some Kaluki,
Right, I think we should get into it then. Enough teasing. This is Ronnie O'Sullivan on The Blank Podcast.
There's a far more amateur spirit about our, what we do.
Oh, that's good. I like a bit of amateur spirit.
How are things?
Yeah. Things are good, you know. I had a bit of a weird week because obviously you had the massive high from winning in Sheffield and that, which was totally unexpected, to be honest with you. I was just saying to the guy who was fixing my lights, he said, oh, it was great, the old snow. And I went, yeah, I actually enjoyed it this time. I said, because it's the first time I went there without absolutely any expectations. I was just happy to win a match and try and not embarrass myself. So obviously to go there with that kind of mindset, no pressure, no expectations, and as well without having a crowd there, because every time I play, there's obviously a crowd and they will get a bit, you know, vocal, come on, Ronnie, come on, Ronnie, and that just encourages the opponent supporters to say, well, come on, Stephen, come on, John, come. And in the end, you're like, I just want to play snooker, you know. I just want to, you know, it becomes like a boxing match. It gets all a bit, and it kind of like, it upsets your own performance and rhythm sometimes. So for me, it was just nice. And everybody said it before me at Newman. They went, this year's tailor-made for you. No crowds, no people, this, that. You know, you ain't got to deal with all the circus that kind of comes with all that. And I kind of thought, yeah, I'll probably enjoy it more, but I don't know, I didn't think that would mean I'd play better snooker or win the tournament. I never thought I'd win the tournament, never in a million years.
Did you find it much easier then without the crowds?
Yeah, huge, massive. And I didn't think it would make much of a difference, because obviously I always thought it's the crucible and that's why you get nervous, but it's not. It's more the crowd and the atmosphere that the crucible brings, you know, and it's and I have to deal with that every match, you know, like the crowds. And, you know, I hear a lot of people say, oh, Ronnie's supporters, that, you know, they shouldn't be allowed in the venue, and I've never wanted that sort of, I've never called for that. I'd much rather have no supporters. I've always preferred being the underdog. I've always preferred going to someone else's backyard, like playing Hendry in Scotland or John Higgins in Scotland or Williams in Wales. I love going in someone else's backyard and spoiling the party, you know. So for me, when I've got that support on my side, you know, you feel that expectation and pressure. And I don't care who you are, no one wants pressure. You know, some people might deal with it better than others, you know, like Tiger Woods, you know, he's constantly under pressure, and so is Federer, Nadal and Djokovic. But I don't think they want it. It just comes with being probably the king of your sport, or the best, that, you know, the number one person in your sport, you know. So Phil Taylor probably had it. I don't like it though, and for me to have no crowds and all that, it kind of made it much more of an enjoyable experience, really.
I have to admit, and no offense to snooker fans, but I wasn't aware that many of them made noise anyway during game. They always seem so quiet during game. Do they actually get rowdy? Is that a thing?
Yeah, obviously you've got your like mainstream sort of people, like probably like 90% of them there just sit there and they don't say much and they enjoy the snooker, and you know, they're like, you know, they just, they like the silence of it, you know. But then you always get a few rowdy ones in there, and you know, and you can never stop that. I'll never have a go at my fans that are rowdy, because I know how passionate they are. And some of my friends at the snooker club, you know, they are typical of what them people are. They're like in their 40s. They've grew up watching me over the years. They're proper loyal supporters, loyal fans. And one of my mates said, he says, I am not dying until you've won another two world titles. And that's just sort of like a reflection of what some of these, you get the odd people that get in the crowd, come and watch you, and that's how they feel. And they get really excited, but the problem is once they get excited, then you get a few people who think, oh, I want to stick up for the other bloke. And they might not be supporters of the other bloke, but they just think, you know, it's just like balancing the books up, really. Do you know what I mean? So you kind of, it like brings in a different kind of atmosphere, really. For me, like I said, but to not have that this year, and like you said, you know, you wouldn't expect that at snooker matches, but at any sporting event or anything like that, you know, you're going to get the odd one that creates a bit of like a football hooliganism, if you like, sort of vibe.
Yeah.
Charles, have you... Mm-hmm.
Was it weird in the final, though? I was going to say... Sorry, Jim. I was going to say, was it... Because you did have some crowds in the final.
Yeah.
So was it... I mean, was that... You know, did you start to feel that expectation again, that pressure?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Because it wasn't... Yeah. I did. Because obviously, like, a few of them, like, really wanted me to win. And every time I got ahead, you know, you could feel them come running. And you kind of feel that sense of responsibility because you don't want to let your fans down and, you know, and your supporters really, you know, because it's although you're out there on your own, they're obviously, you know, they're with you as well, you know. So you feel that sort of, like I said, it's like a pressure, it's a responsibility and you don't want to let them down. And maybe that's something I need to work on is not feeling responsible for people that are supporting me just to try and go out there, play my game, enjoy it. But it's really hard, you know. It's really hard to put that to one side when you're out there and it's on you and you're in the heat of battle, you know.
But I think, I mean, you're such a well-liked sportsman and snooker player. I think those people would love you whatever you did. You know, the pressure's coming from you rather than them, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, you're right. And like, I've worked with Steve Peters and he says exactly what you said, you know. He says... They love you no matter what. Even if you play terrible, they just want to see, you know, turn up. But I think it's just my own sense of just perfectionism, if you like. And I'm not against perfectionism. It's just sort of like I always think it's good because if you aim high and you don't reach to the very top, at least you'll reach somewhere. If you reach somewhere near the top, then it's still going to put you in that sort of that exclusive bracket, if you like. You know, and no one can achieve perfection, but in my pursuit of perfection, it's allowed me to kind of raise my game to a level which I probably wouldn't have raised it to if I wouldn't have been that type of character. So I do have to manage that side of me. But a lot of people see, you know, think it's a bad thing. I think it's a great thing. You know, I'm not settling for second best, no matter what I do. You know, I always want to, you know, it's been my greatest teacher, if you like. You know, it's driven me on to seek out and, you know, work with people like Steve Peters to model myself on the best snooker players that I thought were the best people to model myself on. You know, I'm still learning, even with the younger generation of players coming through. I'm so big in my own world that I think I can't learn. Do you know what I mean? I'm still open to learn. And I think we all have to learn from youngsters. It's like trying to put the AirPods on this morning. Me and Giles were trying to work out. And then my 30-year-old stepdaughter come down and she went, within like 5 seconds, I'm up and running. And I'm like, you know, we need to learn from the younger generation because that's what I learned from Steve Davis and then took the game on just that little bit further, you know. Yeah. And the young kids of today have watched me and they've took the game on a little bit further. So it's up to me now to kind of nick a bit of what they've took, you know, what they've discovered and try and put it into my own game. And with my experience and my wisdom and that, hopefully I can hang on a little bit longer, you know.
Yeah.
I was going to say, have you always had that weight of expectation on yourself? Like, even from your younger days?
Not really.
Has it got worse as you got older?
Not really. It was only that weight of expectation started when I was about 10.
you had a few years.
Up until the age of 9 and a half, I was like under the radar.
Fine.
You know, no one was talking about me. But then when I got to 10, it was like in the local newspaper, in the snooker magazine, and even Steve Davis, when I shook his hand for the first time, he went, "Oh, I know you. I read about you in the snooker magazine." I was only like 10 at the time. I was the youngest to make 100 break. So obviously that around the snooker world, that would have been making noises, you know. But mainstream wouldn't have known that. But in the snooker world, people were already talking about me being the youngest world champion when I was 10. So, yeah. And I always think that's quite a good thing because it's got me used to dealing with expectation and pressure, you know.
Yeah.
I think if I was just thrusted into that when I was like 18, 19, 20 and come out of nowhere, maybe I would have had to learn how to deal with that. But I just think I've been used to it all my life, really. So... I just kind of like roll with it, and you know, I think even especially after this World Championships, it made me realise even more and appreciate how well I've done because I've had to carry that weight of the crowd, the expectation of people, and it's so much easier when you don't have that expectation to do to perform So to perform with that on me, I kind of like, I should really be a little bit less harsh on myself and give myself a little bit of a pat on the back and go, you know what, it's not easy being the favourite every time you get on the start line. It's not easy to keep producing. It's not easy to do that for like 30 years. So I think I will give myself on a pat on the back now.
I think you should. Yeah. You've been the best snooker player for 30 years in the world. I think you should probably give yourself a pat on the back.
Well, yeah.
Not many sportsmen in any you know discipline can say that.
Yeah, no, that's right. You know, but you have, like I said, you kind of have your blinkers on a lot of the time, and sometimes it's like, you know, I'm chasing Hendry, and then I was like, I had my rivalry with John Higgins, and then it was Selby. So you had like these blinkers on, and you forget to sort of look around and go, oh, actually, I'm doing like good, you know, things are, you know, I've overachieved or I've done really well, and kind of start appreciating the stuff. But because you're like in this blinkered sort of world of just kind of what's next, you know, what's the next target, and you know, you don't kind of appreciate or sit back and enjoy it. Like I said, I think when I retire, I'll sit back and go, actually, you know, it was good, you know, and I'm really pleased with what I've achieved. But while you're in it, it's difficult to do that because that's a danger, I think, you know, to start sort of sitting back. The minute you start to sit back and go, oh yeah, you know, it's a little bit like I am now, you know, and start trying to enjoy it a bit, That's the big time you start to slip a bit, you know. If you want to be really super successful, there's times when you're really going to enjoy it. It all comes together and you go, oh, this is great. And probably 20% of my career, I felt like that. But the other 80% of it is just getting the job done, getting out of bed, putting the hours in, putting the work in, putting the groundwork in that no one sees when you don't actually want to do it, you know. So there's a lot of that stuff that has to be done, and you kind of have to have that blinkered mindset, a bit selfish, a bit ruthless in, you know, not ruthless in a horrible sense, but ruthless in the way where you kind of, you know, I haven't got Alex Ferguson sitting on my shoulder saying, if you don't turn up for training, you're on the, you know, I have to kind of, as a single sportsman, I have to find that motivation myself, you know. So I'm a bit like Alex Ferguson and player manager in a way. I have to manage myself.
Yeah.
Is it lonely sometimes being a... We've talked to other people in individual sports. We've had Jamie Murray on, the tennis player, and I think touring particularly for him, it's quite a lonely business.
Yeah, no, it can be, you know, and sometimes it's quite nice to have that loneliness, you know, because it's the only time you get to, you know, sit there, chill out, relax, you do everything. You know, if I want to go for dinner, I go for dinner. If I want to have a sleep, I go for sleep. If I want to play snooker, I play. You know, it's kind of like I'm not in anybody else's time clock, really. But there are times where, you know, that becomes a little bit unhealthy. So, you know, for instance, when I was in Sheffield, I met up with the local running club there, and I met two guys every morning, 7:30 in the morning. We'd meet at the Purple Letterbox at Encliffe Park, and we'd run 3 miles up to the Peak District and 3 miles down, so it was 6 miles in total. And we'd done that every morning. And for me, that was my company, you know, that was my little fix of, and it was the right type of company. You know, I love my running. It makes me feel happy. It's sort of, I can indulge a little bit more with the food. It stops me from wanting to smoke cigarettes, which is one of my vices, you know. So I kind of like running becomes very, very important for me. So, you know, a lot of my friends when I'm on tour will be people that are runners, or like there'll be local runners in Scotland, Northern Ireland, Sheffield, anywhere over the country where I've played snooker, I've always linked up with a local running club. And then they become my friends. So I'll say, look, do you want a ticket for the snooker tonight? And they're like, yeah, why not? So I end up giving them a couple of tickets. And before you know it, I'm around their house having a bit of pie, chips and peas as well.
And the rest is history.
And I've got the remote control, and I'm choosing what to watch on the TV. I'm like, how did that happen?
Well, Jim and I were talking about running before we came on, actually, because Jim, you've only kind of recently got into running, haven't you, a little bit?
I've been running
for quite a few years.
Yeah,
Giles, you've got the experience on me. I started running at the start of lockdown, basically, because there was nothing to do. So it was my only way to sort of get out of the house was to start running.
Yeah.
And it's been amazing. It's been, I mean, almost life-changing. It's so good to sort of get out. You're with your own thoughts. You get to clear your head. As you say, you're not really sort of on anyone else's sort of time frame. So it's my half an hour just to go out and do my own thing.
Yeah.
I feel physically better at the end, mentally as well. Like, I just feel a little bit, almost like set up for the day. Yeah. Like, I've sort of, like, levelled out my head a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's It's one of those cliches. You hear people that run talk about it all the time, how good it is for, you know, mental health and stuff. But it's actually really, it's a cliche that's true. Like, it's just, it's been really, really good for me. So, yeah, I've become one of those. I haven't quite got, like, the running watch or, like, you know, the thing on the arm for, like, the phone and stuff. I haven't got that far yet, but I'm getting there.
You're getting there.
Yeah.
Goes through that. I mean, I had the Garmin. I mean, the best running equipment I ever had was the heart rate monitor. Because I always believe God gave us his body, he gave us what we've got, and you kind of like, you have to run as you feel. So some days if you think, oh, I'm going to run like this, your body might be telling you you're not really up for it. So your heart rate will always tell you where you're at. So if your heart rate's high and you're trying to run faster, that's probably the time to listen to the heart rate and the body and go, look, today's an easy run. Because a lot of running, you know, you should only do 20% of it should be really at a high intensity. The other 80 should be very, very easy and, you know, allowing your body to recover, because you are putting a lot of impact through your joints and your body, and, you know, you need to give you a chance to recover. So I was always terrible at that. I'd always think, like, you know, just run hard as much as I could. And don't get me wrong, I've got results for it, but there's no feeling like the running, you know. And I always think one of the greatest initiatives that have come out in recent years is the park run, you know. And I now know a lot of doctors are kind of subscribing to their, as GPs, for people that are suffering with depression, to go and do the park runs. And I just think it's just brilliant. No matter whatever your state of mind is, you do a run or a 20-minute, half-hour run, you're always going to feel much better afterwards. So I think it's great, like you said, you know, running definitely does help the mood, you know?
That's interesting about the 20%, 80% thing, because I definitely try and go quite fast and get a certain time. But I use my phone. I use Strava on my phone.
Yeah,
other apps are available for anyone.
Yeah, I've got Strava.
Unless Strava want to sponsor us. In that case, it's the greatest app to use for running. But my phone the other day, it's gone towards the end of my run. So I normally get it out of my pocket, try and stop it at 5K. And the screen froze and I couldn't stop it. So my phone, I had to turn it off an hour later. My phone thought I'd done like 30K or something. It thought I'd been running for like an hour. Normally it's like 25 minutes. Like, Jim, Jesus Christ, what have you done today? Because I couldn't turn it off, so that was annoying. So maybe I need better equipment.
The thing I like about Strava, actually, just on a side note, is is people putting in like the locations of stuff. Yeah. So like up the back of where I live in Seaford, up the back there's a little alleyway, and that's called Dog Shit Alley, basically.
Oh, is it?
Someone's obviously typed in Dog Shit Alley, and then, you know, and every time I seem to go faster and faster down Dog Shit Alley, and you get those little achievements.
Yeah.
This is your fastest time down Dog Shit Alley. I quite like that.
What's the story about Dog Shit Alley?
I think Strava's great. It's such a good motivation tool. You know, you see what other guys are doing, and you just think, God, you know, it's great. It is really, really good.
We are definitely getting sponsored by Strava now. Brilliant. Thanks.
So, growing up, you were born in the Midlands, is that right?
Yeah.
And then you grew up in Essex.
Yeah, Ilford. Well, yeah, Ilford doesn't come under Essex, but it's kind of like all around that sort of area,
And so what was the first kind of inkling into sort of snooker for you? Did you enjoy school? Was school something that you got into?
I never really liked school. Was all right until I found snooker, and then sort of snooker sort of become my education, if you like. I started playing when I was about 8. I had a little table, I think, when I was about 7. My dad bought me a 6-foot table for Christmas. And, so I'd just be on that playing, like 5 o'clock in the morning. I'd get up before I had to go to school, do 2-3 hours, come back from school, and I'd be on it, you know, just all the time. And I think my dad the story goes that he said, I just wanted to kind of keep you busy, you know, keep you off the streets. So, you know, I played tennis, I played golf, I played football. But he just see that I really, really love snooker. So he'd drop me down the club in the summer holidays, 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, and come pick me up at like midnight when he'd finished work. So, he said it was like the perfect creche, really. You know what I mean? He said, I knew you were safe.
Yeah.
He was all right. He said, and that was good enough for me. He said, so that's how I kind of fell into it, really.
What kind of club was it? Was it a proper snooker club? Because I played a conservative club, like one of those, well, not constitutional club it was. when I was younger, and we had the pro there. His name was Noel. And he was about 90 years old.
Oh, was he?
And you get in, and all the young players had to brush the tables and iron them before we played. And then he'd come over and he'd start doing his roll ups over the table, and all the backy would go all over.
Oh,
the,
really?
over the face, and you'd be like, ah. Oh. Fuck, I've got to go and do that all again now.
Oh, no. Every club's got a knock. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, I bet they have. I was just wondering if, you had characters like that around, because there just seemed to be a lot of characters like that in the snooker rooms.
Billiard halls were just full of characters. And the first real club I started playing was in Soho in, I think it was Dean Street. It was called the Ambassador Club. And it was an amazing club. It was beautiful. So I started playing there. And then there was a club in City Road that had 5 tables. And I used to play there quite a bit because my dad worked in Soho. So it was kind of like on the way, really. But then I played in a lot of clubs around Essex, Barking, Ilford, Green Lanes. Nelson's was a good club. I'd play everywhere, Barking Side. And every club had its characters, It was just full of characters, unbelievable. And that's the sad thing about snooker for me now, is that obviously there is a lot of the clubs, they're just gone, There are no snooker clubs around anymore, I used to have 6 or 7 good clubs within a 3 or 4 mile radius of where I live. Now I have to travel maybe 30 miles if I want to go and play at a decent, a club where they've got a decent table. So, a lot of the characters have gone from snooker because, I don't know, it was just that era, we was in the 1980s, the 90s.
Yeah.
It's changed a lot, isn't it? Kids are into their iPhones, computers, this and that. So, it's just we live in a different world now, I suppose. But, I definitely remember all the characters and the stories. And I really do miss them days, because for me they were the best days, you just best days, yeah.
Yeah, I loved our snooker club, and just turning up on a Sunday morning and playing 3 or 4 frames and getting beaten most of the time because I wasn't very good. But and just getting all the gear, I had a little case I had a Jimmy White cue.
Yeah.
It was a 2-piece, and I had a little extension of thing. It was just, and like looking after it and putting new, putting new tips on it and all that kind of stuff. All part of that kind of just part of the routine of being a snooker player.
You was a proper snooker player, you lived the life, you're a proper player. Most people turn up, get a wreck, you know all that to do, even around putting tips on, it's a proper player. Proper player.
Yeah, no, but I loved it. I was really, and I remember, I think it was that being in that place. It wasn't, it was being in that that room with like-minded people and just chatting about the game, playing the game and talking about it, and that was exciting.
I liked, we had a Kaluki club going on. There was there'd always be 10 players playing Kaluki. Then you'd have the guy that was on the fruit machine trying to get the 250 quid jackpot. Then you had the fellow who was selling stuff out the back of his car, and then they'd be like, hold on, Bill, what you got? I've got Billy, and then you'd have the billiard players playing Billy, and they were really quiet, and they'd have their tea, and they hated noise, and then you had me on the table too, bashing balls in, and there, it was just it was so much going on at the club. And we all got on. We all knew each other, and it was just it was our church, really. We went there just to kind of get our happiness, if you like. It's 13 card rummy, so it's sort of like an advanced game of rummy, really. So, where you get 4 of 1, 3 of another, or 3 of 1, that's rummy. But this would be 13 cards, and you could only pick up.
Okay.
If someone threw a card and you could see what it was, you could only pick up if you had 40 points or more to put down. And it was 1, 2, 4. Wow. So it was, £4 for the game, £2 for Kluge or something like that. I can't remember. But, that was how a lot of the snooker players earned their living, people like Ken Doherty and Eugene Hughes. They were hustlers, so they'd sit there and play Kaluki for 2-3 hours a day, make their 50-60 quid, and then they'd go and do their 3 or 4 hours snooker, that was the life of a snooker player. Wow. I obviously didn't have to play Kaluki for my money, because my dad had done quite well, and he didn't want me to get involved in that sort of gambling sort of culture, so he always had enough money to put it behind the bar and just wanted me to focus on the snooker. But, a lot of the players earned their living playing cards, You know, that was it. And if they won a tournament, that was a bonus. But from day to day, you know, their money was earned playing Kaluki.
Ken
was great. Ken was good. I've got a lot of respect for Ken because he came over, he had nothing. And, you know, he was a fantastic player and he would win a lot of Pro-Am events. But he was just always sort of, I call him, he's like the politician of the snooker players. You know, he can go both ways as well. You know, he's not just totally straight. You know, he'll get down there and play his cards, do what he's got to do, you know, hustle his way through. But then he knows when to sort of draw the lines. You know what I mean? So, yeah, Ken was, he's a good role model, really.
Because it seems to me, from what you're saying there, and you were saying, like, obviously school wasn't for you, but you basically, in the snooker clubs, you get a different sort of education. You are getting an education, but it's like an education in life and hustling and surviving, almost more important.
Yeah, it was like that, you know. So, like, whenever I'd go to school, you know, I used to get on better with the teachers because I was surrounded with adults a lot of the time. So a lot of the teachers, I could have a, you know, we used to get on well, you know. I was like, although I was 11 or 12 or whatever I was like a bloke, you know. I was used to being around, you know, adults and how to behave and how to talk to adults.
Playing Kaluki, you know, in the teacher's room.
Playing Kaluki. So it was kind of like, you know, it was, I had a different sort of upbringing. You know, I always say I was a lot older, probably before I should have been older, really. I was never at gallivanting, messing around with, you know, with my mates. Like, from the age of 11 or 12, that was it. I was sort of playing full-time snooker, really. And I was very naughty as a kid, so I got banned from Pontins when I was 10. I got thrown off a Pontins campsite.
As you do.
And then I just kind of, like, very quickly, my dad was quite a strict sort of parent, if you like, and he kind of knocked that out of me. So I had to really, like, knuckle down and start behaving myself. Even down the snooker club, you know, a lot of the guys were saying, look, Ron, you've got to get your son in order. He's a nightmare, you know. So I had to start to behave a little bit. But it was good, you know. You all go through a learning sort of period, you know.
So why did you get banned from Pontins?
It was for a kind of number of things. It was like, you know, like when you lose your driving license, 3 points for this, 3 points for that, three. And eventually I just go, right, you're banned. And I think diving off the top board and trying to land on the old granny's head with the first one.
Yeah, that's it.
I wasn't trying to dive on her head, but I just think, you know, diving off the board, I was just unsettling all the middle-aged people there trying to enjoy their breaststroke. And then I think the other one was, I can't remember what the other one was. I think I've got caught throwing eggs where there was egg fights going on. So that got reported. And then the final one was, apparently I threw a beer glass, which I did, but I didn't throw it at someone. I threw it on the floor because this guy was chasing me. So I just wanted it to smash and hopefully he wouldn't want to run across the glass. But that was the final 3 points. And then that was me banned.
I think it's a badge of honour.
That was my naughty days over. After that, I had to behave. You know, my dad was like, I'm not having this anymore, you know. So I had to be on my best behaviour. And then 2 weeks later, we was in a snooker club in Holborn and I was with a guy called Stuart Parnell, who was like a really good friend of mine. But he was like 21 at the time and I was only about, I must have been 10. So he was around about 20, yeah. And he was with another guy called Darren Villiers, who Darren managed Stuart, but they were like proper naughty boys, you know what I mean? They went, here, hold the queues. So I rolled in these three big queues, and they just started throwing loads of stink bombs in the club, right? And this is like 2 weeks after I've just been banned, so I've got to be on my best behaviour. So I'm running out with these queues. They've legged it. I get the blame for the stink bombs, and my dad's like fuming. And he's like, oh. I went, Dad, it wasn't me, I promise you. And I had to throw Stuart in. I said, it was Stuart.
Oh, no. My dad got
Stuart on the phone. He went, oh, I need to know the truth. And Stuart, it was us. Otherwise, I don't think I'd be in there. My dad would have, that'd been my life over.
That would have been the end
stink
of the
spot. So then I had to stop hanging. Yeah, stink bombs. They threw a load of these stink bombs. They started off throwing them in the club. So there was a prime one. And they was knocking them out there. And we'd all be going, God, it stink. And then they just threw a load. But they'd already given me their cue. So I've got all these cues. And I'm thinking, if I get caught, they're going to know it's me. So I had to run with these cues. But that was it. As soon as that, I had to stop hanging around with people like Stuart and that. You know, I just kind of like, I had to be like on my best behaviour, you know.
Whatever happened to stink bombs? I remember at school, stink bombs was a very 90s thing, wasn't it? But disappeared.
We're 80s. We used to be able to get, well, it used to be joke shops, didn't they?
That's right, yeah.
Go and buy, like, yeah.
Yeah.
Get your...
You just get like 10 in a packet.
Yeah.
Clip the lid
itching off powder.
That's what I mean. What's happened to them, the good old days? You know
different
what I mean?
Times. Yeah, I know. Different times.
Yeah, and like you could get like sort of really hot chewing gum that would like be really like
that's
hot.
Right. Yeah.
So you'd like, yeah.
Kids today, they don't know. They'll never have the pleasure of letting off a stink bomb.
Crazy.
So, what was the first tournament then? What was the first tournament you entered? So you obviously started to duckle down a bit more. After your stink bombs.
Phase.
When did you start really, though? I mean, I think I read somewhere about around 11, you started to realise you were capable of doing something.
Yeah, I think when I'm about 11, I started winning like quite a few junior tournaments. And I remember playing and kind of, yeah, I think you just get like a little bit of winning breeded confidence. And then I'd start playing in sort of like, they were called like intermediate tournaments, so it wasn't for the best players. The best players could play in it, but it was more for like people that weren't at that high level. But it was like full of adults, and I would go in there, and that'd be a good place for me to test myself. And I remember I played a guy called Dave Finbo, who was a top amateur, and I was only 11 at the time, and I thought, like Dave Finbo, he was like a legend. Do you know what I mean? He was like, there was no way I was going to get a frame off him. And I remember playing him, and I think he beat me like 3-1 or 3-2. I can't remember what it was, but I thought, you know what? I was just surprised that I'd actually give him a game. And from them, it was them little results in them sort of tournaments that kind of gave me confidence. And I think when I got to about 11, I was winning a lot of junior stuff. And then when I got to 12, I started to beat a lot of top amateurs and professionals on a regular basis. So, you know, and then I won my first Pro-Am tournament, which was just before my 13th birthday, which was like, I still now rate that as one of my biggest achievements, because, you know, I was playing top amateurs and pros. And I remember there was a point in that tournament where something switched in me where I potted a ball. And I remember it was about in the last 16 of the tournament, and I potted a ball and I cleared up. And every time I went to the table, I thought, if I'm given one chance, I fancy I'm going to clear up. And that was the first time that I thought, it doesn't matter who's sitting in that chair. If I feel like this and I have the confidence to do it and I'm doing it, then, you know, my destiny is in my own hands, really. But that was at 12, you know. So, you know, from that moment onwards, I started to, like, it became like, hold on, like, it's not just about having a laugh now. This is about, you know, I just feel like, I feel like nothing's impossible for me at this game now, you know, at such an early age.
Yeah. What were the opponents like losing to a 12-year-old? Were they sort of graceful, or were they like, oh, for fuck's sake?
I don't know if you've heard of a guy called Peter Ebden. He was world champion. So at the time, obviously he knew me growing up and he knew how good I was and stuff like that. But Peter was probably about 7-8 years older than me. So when I was 12, he'd have been 19, 20. He was just knocking on the door, turning professional. And I remember I played him in a pro-am in Witten, and I might have been about 14 at the time. And it was in the semi-finals, and this was like the biggest pro-am there was. It was like £1,000 to the winner, 128 players, everyone from Leeds down to the southern of England was there. And I remember I had him in the semi-finals, and I beat him 3-2. And afterwards, he was pacing up and down. I thought, that's a bit strange, you know. And he came up to me in my face, and he went, you're a good player and all that. He said, but you'll never, ever beat me again. And I was like, wow, you know. And I just remember just saying to him, like, I can't remember what I said to him, but my mate told me, he said, you just went to him, I've got you in the head, Pete. You know what I mean? Like, and he just cracked. And then the following week, his brother-in-law said to me, he said, you must have really done his head in. He said, because we drove 50 miles up the wrong way at the motorway before we realised...
So he's thinking about you.
Yeah, I think there was that side of it where Ebden felt like, you know, he was the boss because he was winning them tournaments week in, week out. Whenever we turn up to them tournaments and everyone see Ebden, they was like, oh, he's won it. And don't get me wrong, there was a lot of good players. Someone like Anthony Hamilton, who was a prolific winner on the amateur circuit and a very good professional. There was a lot of good players there. So even though everyone thought Ebden was going to win it, he never always won it, but he would, you know, at the end of the, you know, when you get up to club Monday, you go, who won Whittam? They go, Ebden. You go, oh, yeah, he's won it again. Mm-hmm. So he was kind of like the king, you know, he was the king of the Pro-Am circuit. So for me to take that scalp, that kind of got around the snooker world, I was like, fuck, you know. And then I'd turn up to tournaments, and I remember my mate Robert, who used to drive me, he said, I've just seen Anthony Hamilton at the toilet. I went, oh, yeah. He went and he said, because he knew Robert was my mate, and he went, you ain't brought Ronnie with you, have you? And he went, yeah, and he went, fuck. do you know what I'm saying? So, So that was Layla just trying to call me, so that's probably why you got cut off there.
No worries.
But there was all them sort of stories, you know, of people that are trying to, you know, like this young kid coming along, you know. So you had people like Hamilton that truly respected me and was, you know, he wasn't such a competitive animal. And then you had someone like Ebden, who was like super competitive, and he took it really personal. And it was like, he obviously couldn't sleep at the thought of like that I was cut up, that I was around, you know. So,
but they must have all known, oh, hang on, we're all dealing with someone with real potential here, like a future superstar. They must have known that you were going to go on, and they knew that they were taking on someone really special.
Well, that's what I'm saying. At the time, I had such blinkers on that I was just, it's like you buy a nice car, but everybody else gets to look at it apart from you. And it's like me with a Snoopy. Yeah. You kind of like, you're inside the car. You don't get to see what everybody else sees, you know. And it's the same with a snooker career. I never really got to see how everybody perceived me, or I never got to see, was I really that good? What do I do that makes them think like that? Because I still have days where I think, fucking hell, I'm not really striking it as well as I should be, or this and that, and I can be my own worst critic. So really, everybody else has enjoyed seeing my career, and everybody else has kind of made these predictions, but I never believed that, you know, I was going to be a champion. I never believed it. You know, I've always never had that belief. I call it like a bit delusional. Some people, like, I hear them speak and they still think they're going to win the world championships. And I feel like saying, mate, you ain't even going to qualify for the world championships, but they still believe it.
Yeah.
I don't have that type of belief, but the belief that I have is that when I get on the table, if it switches and it clicks, I know the opponent is gonna have to do something out of the ordinary to beat me. You know, maybe Stephen Hendry or John Higgins, as long as they played their best and I was playing my best, then yeah, it was like a 50-50, you know, it could be anyone's game. But anybody else I played, if I hit that spot and I was penetrating the ball and I felt like I could, you know, a complete mastery over that ball, and pure striking, then I just always knew that I had too much for everybody else, you know. So
is that the sort of feeling? Is that the same feeling you get when, because obviously you're when you're potting 147s in like 5 minutes and you're sort of smashing it? Is that the sort of same feeling where you can just sense, oh, I'm completely on it today?
Yeah.
Can you explain what that feeling's like? I'm guessing it's almost like a sort of serenity where you're just like, everything I touch is going to go in today.
I mean, like you say, like. I people say you have days like that. I've had years where I felt like that, you know, in a whole spell, like 2-3 years, where every time I went to the practice table, every time I went to the match table, just everything was just out the middle, you know. I was just, you know, I was pinging the ball so well, I was penetrating through the ball, you know, I could put that white anywhere I wanted to, and it just became so easy in many ways. And you know, now I have spells like that now and stuff like that, but yeah, you just have times when, you know, the game is just, you're just at one with the game, you know. And people say, oh, you have to get in that zone. I never used to have to work to get in that zone. As soon as I got my cue out and I started striking the ball, you get in that zone, you know. You just kind of, you just get so engrossed in it, and you get so excited by it, and you're so deep in, it's like a meditation, you know. I've never meditated to that level, but when I spoke to somebody and explained to him how I kind of feel when I play snooker. He was a real meditator. I mean, he went to Canada and didn't speak to someone for 40 days. That's how serious this guy was about meditation. Wow. But when I explained to him about how I get in the zone with snooker, he was like fascinated. He went, that's meditation. I was like, oh, I don't know. You know, I'm just describing to you how what it feels like when I'm out there. So, yeah, I think you kind of, you know, that when you play to that high level, which is not all the time, like I say, I have spells where I'm like it for a month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months. I had a spell where I'd like it for a year, 2 years, 3 years. You know, and sometimes I go a year, 18 months where you can't find it, you know, and that's the most frustrating thing at all. But when you're in it, it's like, it's amazing, you know, it's the best feeling in the world. That's why you keep playing the game, I believe.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, in those times where you're not feeling it, are those the times where you're thinking, I can't bother with this anymore?
Yeah, absolutely, because you're missing out on the glory, you know. It's like having all the, it's like you've got a big bit of cheesecake there and you're only eating the strawberry. You know, you're not getting the full whack, you know, you want to hit the sweet spot, you know. And so, yeah, I mean, I've had spells where, you know, where I couldn't put a ball over, you know, 6 feet. And to be fair, there was a lot of spells in this year's World Championships where, you know, I was struggling, you know, it was really tough, you know, the game didn't come into me, I wasn't penetrating through the ball as well as I liked, I wasn't able to keep the white on line over distance, you know, around the balls, like, you know, the white wasn't, you know, where it break building and the white didn't have to travel that far, I kind of got away with it a bit, but there was a lot of times in that World Championship where I felt very, very vulnerable, and I think that each match I played, I just thought, right, I know what I need to beat this guy. Whether I found it or not, that was another thing. But I knew what I thought could kind of keep me in the game, you know, and give me a chance of winning. So each match I kind of had to adopt a different style, if you like, or a different technique, which I thought would just give me the upper hand on my opponent. Whereas when you're in the full swing of it, I never worry about what I need. I never worry about my opponent. I just go out there and I just lay it all on the table and I go, right, you know, if you can beat me, how am I playing now? Then I'm going to just look at you in a different way and think, wow, you've got something, you know, you're a very, very good player. Because normally, you know, that they can't win, you know, that, well, they don't win, you know. I've always got too much for them.
It must be, I think for individual sports, I find it fascinating, those moments where it's not going well and like how people deal with it, especially in a sport like snooker where there's like an etiquette. Like there was a clip the other day, and I think it was from the most recent World Championships, where some guy, the white wasn't working, and he like put his middle finger at the white ball. Did you guys see that? He was like, F off the white. And obviously, like the umpire was like, can you like not do that? But it must be so difficult. Like I play football, and obviously in football, if you're not playing well, you can just like smash the ball away or something, or like foul someone, and you can get that frustration out. In snooker, you've got to like keep it all inside. It's a really interesting psychological kind of thing to keep on.
It's just emotions, you know, and like in some sports, it's okay to let your emotions out, and you know, in some sports, you're not, you know, in snooker, you're not supposed to let your emotions out, so it's all like internalized, really. But you have to find techniques, and that's what I say. The work that I've done with Steve Peters, I mean, we all have a weakness in whatever we do, and mine probably was not my mind, not being able to deal with pressure, not able to deal with clutch moments, but just like, you know, from start to finish for a tournament, you know, I'm probably not going to be on my A game all the time. So it's them times where I'm on my B and my C game. Am I prepared? Am I able to not sabotage my own chances of winning? And I, like, let my emotions get the better of me, throw my toys out my pram. And, you know, that goes on for an hour. Before I know it, I've lost the match. I'm sitting in my hotel room. I'm thinking, shit, you know, I've messed up there, really. I could have probably knuckled down, not been too hard on myself, and found a way to win and try and live to fight another day. And I think the missing ingredient for me was being able to deal with them moments. And I think working with Steve Peters, well, I know since working with Steve Peters, you know, I really studied what he had to tell me, you know, of how to deal with my emotion, basically. And, you know, I think I'd done that as good in this World Championship, considering how I was playing. I needed that emotional stability and that able to kind of like, you know, deal with the really shit moments of how I was feeling. Not how I was feeling, but how I was playing, you know. I just wasn't able to penetrate through the ball. And there was sometimes the white was oscillating and I thought, oh, you know, you know, anything can happen here. So rather than kind of panic and start stressing out, you know, I'd be like, okay, you know, we'll deal with that on the practice table.
Yeah.
Once I've finished this session of snooker, this is not the time to start worrying about that now, because panic just produces more panic. So it's just trying to stay calm in them situations to then allow myself, you know, to put it right, to come back in the evening session and put it right, which I did on most occasions at this year's World Championships, and come out victorious. So that was only through mental skills. That wasn't through my ability to pop balls and, you know, and penetrate in a white really well, because there was a lot of times I wasn't able to do that, and I had to kind of be patient and not sabotage my chances of winning.
Do you have to break it down in those moments then? Like you know, you said like sessions, but do you even break it down as far as just like frame by frame and taking it like that?
Yeah, every year you kind of like, you know, start, when I first won the World Championships, I thought, I kind of got, you kind of like get into the rhythm of it. If you get into like the first two, over the first round, you get into the second round, you start to realise that the matches are so long that there's no point going into the match thinking, oh, I just want to get to 13, because it's so far away that, you know, it's sort of, there's no point. You know, you go, right, I'm going to play these four frames. We'll see how we get on. And then we're going to play the next four frames, and then we'll see where we are. And then we go to the next session, and then we're going to play another four frames, and we'll see where we are. And then we're going to play another four. And you kind of just break it down. And then before you know it, you go, oh, I'm 10-6 up, or I'm 11-5 up, or I'm 7-2 down. And, you know, and you kind of like start to just play like little mini sessions, if you like, and that's just probably the best way to do it, because at least then if you get off to a good start, you don't get carried away. If you get off to a bad start, you're not kind of like throwing, you're not saying I can't win this match, you're just saying, you know, it just hasn't been a good eight frames or a good four frames. It's, you know, my next eight frames could be the best eight frames I play in the history that I've ever played at Sheffield. So, you know, you always have to try and break them down, and as the match goes on in a longer match, the dynamics change quite a lot. So at the start, you might be bossing it, and then towards the middle part, he's bossing it. So now all of a sudden, he's got the momentum going into the last session. But can he do two really good sessions back to back? It's your chance to then recover. And, you know, it's all about the law of averages sometimes, that, you know, not one person can't dominate for the whole time. So you kind of like, you've got all that going through your head. But with normal tournaments, it's not like that. It's just like, boom, first to five. And it's, but with the World Championships, it carries that sort of, you know, different sort of ebb and flows, if you like.
I think that's really good advice, actually, that could almost be applied to any situation. Like if I'm playing Sunday League football, if I get picked, which doesn't happen very often, but if I get off the bench and play and I'm having a bad game, maybe I can think, right, my next pass, my next 5-yard pass, I'm just going to make that as good as possible. Mm. My next shot on goal, I'm going to get on target. Mm. Or if I'm running, I can be like, right, up until that lamppost, I'm going to go as well as I can, and then pass that lamppost to the next one. I think breaking these things down, even if you're having like a bad day, you know, you're just having a shit day where you feel terrible, you think, okay, I'm going to get to lunchtime. You know, I'm going to have my lunch. I'm going to get to dinner. I think that's a really good way of helping yourself through any situation. You know, certainly snooker, but I think that's actually really good advice for anyone having a bad time.
Yeah, definitely. And that's why I say, you know, like snooker's been the best teacher for me, because I've met Steve Peters and I've worked on this stuff. And after the World Championships finished and I come home and things weren't, you know, I just went, you know what, we'll deal with that later. Let's just be present and kind of like get through this little thing. And, you know, and like Steve Peters says, he says things are fickle. So in the morning you might be really wound up, things ain't going your way. By the afternoon, you could be like flying, you know, so you've got a good bit of news or a phone call, or, you know, you've run your best 5K and whatever, and all of a sudden you're in a really good place. So, you know, he says it's sometimes we get stuck in the treacle, you know, we kind of get stuck in the fucking shit of what's going on, instead of like, you know, boxing it, put it to one side and just kind of, you know, just try and break things down instead of just, you know.
I think I need Steve Peters in my life, I think.
Yeah, I think we all do, actually. Yeah. Are you unique in that way, Ronnie, that you work with someone like Steve? Or are other players starting to do that now?
No, I think there's certain players on the circuit that that can benefit from a sports psychologist, and a lot of them know that, you know, that that's what they need. And then there's other players on the circuit, they just don't need it, you know. They're just kind of built to play. I call them like built to play snooker, because so someone like John Higgins, you can't really help him mentally, or someone like Selby, they're so good mentally anyway, that that's their strong point. But I'm sure they have weaknesses in their area, in their game, that they need to work on, but probably just not on the mental side. But like I said, you know, we all have a weakness, and I think it's up to us to improve that weakness so it doesn't become so much of a weakness. And like I said, my weakness is probably, you know, being a bit emotional sometimes, and when it's good, it's great, and if it's not so good, I kind of think, you know what, I'd rather go home and start running around Epping Forest instead of playing in the World Championship. So that's a real sabotage type of thought, you know, where someone like John Higgins, he would never, that wouldn't even enter his head, you know, he'd be in there present, playing each session, each ball, like his life depends on it, and then when he finishes a session, then he'd think about going for a run, where me, I'm doing it during the tournament or during a match as a way of a cop-out, you know, so I have to manage that. And I know that voice, you know, when it's coming on, I'm like, oh, here he is, you know, like, you know, like, you know, I don't buy into it anymore. But up until 10 years ago, I used to really believe that voice, and I would sabotage, lose, go out for my run, get home. And I wouldn't be like ultra disappointed, but I'd think, you know what, I wish I was still in York playing in the UK Championships. You know, I wish I would have tried that little bit harder and maybe not throw the towel in, you know. So I think that's been the difference in the last 10 years, is that I haven't thrown the towel in because I've worked on with Steve Peters. So I was really lucky, really, because I probably wouldn't be playing there if it wasn't for Steve, you know?
I was going to say, yeah, because it's often you hear sports people talk, when they get older, they do tend to appreciate the mental side of things. Yeah. And that emotion, it's so funny you talk about that, because I think when you've got supremely talented sports people, as you clearly are, but it happens in other sports as well, that the people that are the most talented seem to also be the most emotional. And then the ones that maybe are less so, I was gonna actually do some very unfair comparisons. I was gonna say you're like a sort of a Wayne Rooney, who's like insanely talented, but the emotion with it. And Higgins is more like a sort of Gary Neville, where it's just like, you know, maybe that's being unfair on. It's probably very unfair on John, but a bit more level-headed, able to just take what comes with things and sort of get on with it.
Yeah, absolutely. A Wayne Rooney needs a Gary Neville just to kind of like Wayne did it, and Wayne and listen to him and go, I know, you know, and that's what Steve Peters is for me. He's my Gary Neville. He just sits there and he's just sort of like, you know, I never question what he says. I know what he's saying is 100% right. It's not always easy to apply, but it's nice to have them sort of, like you say, level-headed voices in the background just to sort of steady the ship a bit, you know, and then it allows Wayne Rooney to go and do what he does, which is, you know, turn matches and win games.
Was that hard to find that relationship, though? Because that's obviously a very crucial relationship, yours and Steve's. Was that did you work with other people before you met with him?
Yeah, I worked with a few people. You know, one of my best relationships I had with a guy called Pete Cohen, and he's become like one of my really, really good friends now. He was just so funny, and we had such a good time. But he was really into the sports psychology side of stuff, you know. And he opened my mind to sort of, you know, to not just focus on the snooker and the cue action and all that sort of stuff, to try and use my mind to kind of channel and be in a better place while I was playing. And then we lasted for about 2-3 years, and it was a great, you know, it was great for me to, you know, to have that relationship. But then I went to work with Steve Peters. And Steve came at it from a completely different angle, because it was more bespoke. So rather than sort of looking at just our emotions, it was like looking at my emotions, looking at my trigger points, looking at my, a bit like when you go into therapy, you know, look at what's the root of it? Why is this happening? And it kind of like, I was able to then not just take one shoe fits all. It was like I was creating my own sort of rules, if you like, you know, of how and what to do, you know, and now we kind of like understand my triggers and, you know, what can potentially go wrong before it goes wrong. So I'm much more prepared for when it comes on me to go, okay, I know what's going on here. We can deal with that. Da, 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 and, you know, and allow myself to play, you know, and be, you know, in the right state to play top level snooker.
Isn't it interesting, that idea of like asking for help? Like, I think a lot of people maybe don't understand, even the top level sports people need help sometimes, and we can all improve ourselves and we can all get better at what we do just by asking for help. I think it's almost like human nature. We're social beings, aren't we? And actually, I think we can all help each other, but sometimes just the simple task of getting someone to help you out, and as you say, like work on your things that need to be worked on, emotions and stuff, can really, really help us. But it's just a simple thing, asking for, you know, reaching out.
I've gone to tournaments and I've been on my own, and like I said, it's nice. You get into your own groove, you come in, you kind of, if you whatever's going on in that tournament, you know, you read a book. Like for me, if I'm on my own, I read a book, I watch a bit of Sky Go, I watch a bit of Only Fools and Horses at the interval, and sometimes that's just what I need.
Yeah.
But then it's nice, like you say, other times where I've got Steve Peters and we're working on stuff, and it's good to have sounding boards, and, you know, and it's sort of like, you know, to have someone like that in my corner is massive, you know. Like I said, you know, the reason why I can go and watch Sky Go in the interval is because I've done the work with Steve Peters, and I realised that there's nothing I can do in this 20 minutes other than just relax and just be as relaxed as possible, you know, and trust myself, you know. Sometimes knowing just to do that is not easy to do, because sometimes I'll get that 20 minutes and I might want to go on a practice table and start trying to find a cue action or fiddle about in a grip, and I've got 20 minutes, there's no point, you know. Go in your room, chill out, watch a bit of Sky Go, a bit of Only Fools and Horses, put the kettle on. And, you know, that's the best thing to do most of the time, 99% of the time. So, you know, having worked with Steve Peters, I realised that little 10 minutes on the practice table is no point, yeah. You know, whereas before working with Steve Peters, I do that quite a lot, you know. So it's just learning how to trust yourself and just allow stuff to come to you rather than you chase it.
Is that your go-to show then, Only Fools?
Yeah, I love a bit of Only Fools or Storage Hunters. Or Storage Hunters, was
yeah,
it?
Heavy
D. Is it Heavy D?
Yes. Yeah.
Ah, bloody hell. I was watching a bit of Heavy D, mate. It was just funny. Yeah, so I was watching a bit of that.
He's a character, isn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah. Yeah, he's nuts, isn't he? Me and Layla spotted him once in Israel. I was like, that's Heavy D. And she was like, no. And we started chasing him. And I was like, Heavy D. And he was like, he just put his arm out the window. And then he see it was me. He went, fucking hell, you got it. And then he started tweeting me and that. It was funny. Funny.
I was going to say to you, you kind of alluded to it earlier a little bit about the circus that comes along with doing those big tournaments.
Mm.
Are those, can that be frustrating? Like interviews and just generally, like, just, I guess, the whole kind of press intrusion and stuff around that, around a big tournament?
Yeah, I mean, this is part and parcel of it, I suppose. But this year was so much different to normal years because, you know, there was just you and the press and a few people there, and everything was done from a distance and stuff like that. So you felt a little like less the crowd, you know, you wasn't crowded all the time. But it's tough, you know, that's the side, especially for me as well in snooker, because every time I finish a match, you know, you've got to do your, you know, the media want to hear what I've got to say, you know, and a lot of the other players escape that, I think, so, which is much better for them because there's less demand, you know, that, you know, if they're going to choose someone to have an interview after or to try and get a story, they're going to use me or they're going to use John Higgins or they're going to use Selby or they're going to use Judd Trump. So a lot of the top players kind of get a lot more, they're in that much more demand. So, yeah, that is tough to deal with it. And that's why I didn't play in the Masters this year, because I just didn't, at this stage in my career, I just didn't want to have to do stuff that I wasn't comfortable with, you know. And like I said, the pressure of the Masters, the pressure of the world. I mean, I wasn't even playing the World Championships until my sponsors sat down and went, well, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm not really feeling the World Championships. And they went, okay, well, we'll incentivise you. So I was like, okay. So we kind of, it was more like a group decision for my sponsors and my management. They kind of put something together and they went, well, look, you know, we would like you to play in it. And I went, well, I don't really want to play in it. So I said, well, if we can do a few little things around it, and, you know, so it all become a bit more of a team effort in a way. And it was kind of like, just show my face, do my best. They were happy that I was doing that. And, you know, and then I ended up bloody winning it. So they were extra, extra happy. So, I wasn't intending on playing the Worlds. But then obviously COVID kicked in and I've had this massive time off. And I just thought, you know what, actually, I wouldn't mind going in a few balls, you know. So it all turned out well for in that respect. But usually the press and the media, not that I have anything against the press and the media, because, you know, I've got a great working relationship with everybody. It's just the time and the energy and you know, and you're just spouting off the same thing that you said in one interview into this interview, and you just think, why can't everyone just get together and do one 10-15 minute interview and we can all go home? But, you know, I have to do this one, I have to do that one, I have to do that. And I think, I've just said that next door.
Well, there's etiquette. There's like, what press is always quite archaic sometimes in the way they work, because there's always been like, well, this is how we've done things.
Yeah.
It's the same. I used to work in football coverage. It's the same sort of thing with like press embargoes and stuff, which in my opinion are completely pointless. But it's just like the way it's always been done. But is that the sort of thing, that sort of like boredom with the press that leads you to sometimes say more outspoken things, where you just kind of think, I'm not going to censor myself. I'm just going to say what I think, whether it's like, you know, slagging off venues or something, or what you said recently about the younger players, which was hilarious, by the way. But you just think, I just don't really sort of care anymore. I'm just going to say what I think.
Yeah, I think I've kind of got to that point now where, you know, I love snooker and I love whatever, you know, playing and stuff like that. But I've just got to the point, and I think it's a good point to get to in your life, where you just think, I don't actually care anymore. I care, but I don't care enough to worry about what they think or what they, you know, have I said something that I shouldn't have said? I'm not going to sit there and start scrolling down the comments. Oh, this one said that about me. Actually, I like it. I like it, you know. I actually sometimes think I watched the Michael Jordan, I don't know if you watched it, The Last Dance.
Oh, I've not seen it yet, apparently.
Yeah, it's worth watching, but you watch Jordan, and Jordan, when I'd go to a match and I needed to piss someone off, or I needed to do something to give myself a kick up the arse. And that's all I've done my whole career. So every time I kind of say certain things, it's like, I've said it, but I know that I've got to produce now. I've kind of given myself a bit of a sticky situation, and it's like the pressure's on. You know, if I get beat, they're going to go, "Hey, look what you just said." But then usually I kind of turn it into a fire and a determination, where I go, right, I'm having this. And it's kind of like, I never really heard anyone explain it like that. But when Jordan said it, I thought, he actually knew what he was doing. And it's kind of like, I know what I'm doing, but I never realised why I was doing it. And I think I just enjoy that sort of, that bit, you know, like where they said, oh, I don't know what they were saying, I'm disrespecting the game. But actually I've got to the point, because I used to care, I used to think, oh, I don't want them to think that, you know. But now I just think, I actually don't care.
Yeah.
It feels really nice. You know, it really does. You know, and I just sort of like, if they said to me, look, you've done one too many bad things, you're near bad from snooker, I'd go, thank you, you've done me a favour, because I've been dying to retire for years, but I just can't, because I keep winning, but you put me out of my misery. So it's like, I can't lose, really. I can't lose. It's like, whatever way they go with it, I just think, it suits me, you know?
But I think, like, snooker is quite a sort of, again, I don't mean to insult anyone, but it's quite a sort of stuffy, that's the impression I get, a sort of stuffy sport, where actually people don't say what they think. So I think it's actually quite refreshing and freeing. And I'm guessing for you, it probably feels a bit freeing as well to say what you want. And you're in a position where you can anyway. People probably respect you more because you're actually saying what you think. You're adding a bit of entertainment to it. So as you say, there's no losers really, is there? Apart from the younger players. But, you know, they'll get used to it.
No, listen. Part of me, it's like I said, you know, like it's like they said to me, why do you think you're still at the top? And I thought, well, like, I've got 6 interviews to do here. So I'm going to give you this answer and I'm going to give you that answer. Yeah. And my answer was, they just, you know, was what it was. You know, they're not good enough. And, you know, in my opinion, they wouldn't make good enough, you know, whatever I said. And so that, and I just think it's okay to, you know, to say stuff like this. Just, you know, I wasn't slagging anyone off. And in fact, I was hoping that in some ways it would inspire a lot of the younger generation to kind of go, you know what, I'm going to prove him wrong. Yeah. You know, because that's all I've done all my life when I was a kid growing up. You know, I'd get knocks, and every time I got a knock, it was like, that just made me more and more determined to want to become a better and a better player, you know. So for me, a knock was fantastic. So, yeah, I'm knocking them, but I'm also hoping that it gives them a nudge to go, you know what, I'm going to go and watch a Tiger Woods documentary. I'm going to go and watch a Michael Jordan documentary and see what it takes to be the best. And then once I've studied them, I'm then going to take that into my world and, you know, I'm going to become the best snooker player I can possibly be. And that's what I'm saying, you know, a lot of these snooker players, yeah, every player on the tour is capable of beating anyone on their day. But it's not good enough to just to have a good day. You've got to have good months, good years, good decades. You know, so I don't buy into this, everyone's good enough to beat everyone on the day. Yeah, they are, But we're not talking about being good enough in your day. We're talking about having a good career, you know, and it's and days yeah. ain't enough. You know, you have to have good months and years to stay around and hang around long enough. And that's what I'm hoping by saying what I said in a way is kind of going to give these youngsters a kick up the arse to kind of like, you know, to seek out. And there are a couple on the circuit, and Kyron Wilson is definitely one of them. And another guy is a guy called Lewis Heathcote, who I spot that they have what it takes to kind of hang around and get the most out of their career. So I just wish there was more players like me, John Higgins, Mark Williams, Stephen Maguire, Barry Hawkins, you know, that generation of players that grew up. I just wish there was, like, you know, an influx of them players coming in, but I just don't see it. And it's just sort of like, you know, I'm like, and a lot of it goes back to what I was saying to you. You know, years ago, there was lots of snooker clubs and there were so many players to sort of, you know, to look up to. You know, now there ain't no one for them to look up to because there ain't enough snooker clubs around.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, when I heard you making those comments, I said to my wife, I said, I think it felt like you were trying to light a fire under, you know, particularly like in your industry as well,
yeah.
to say, look, you know, this isn't good enough. You know, we've got a lot of players who are old, a lot older, winning big tournaments. Where you know, where are the younger players coming
yeah.
from? And like you know, we've talked about it a few times on here already, like about the clubs not being there, not being available. What can snooker be doing? What can the industry be doing more to sort of promote the sport?
I think you just got to kind of, like, for me, it's about competition, you know, and giving young kids the chance to play amongst each other. You know, it's like growing up, like I said, you know, there's a lot of junior tournaments and you would become the best junior in your club, and then you become the best junior in Essex, and then you become the best junior in the southern England, and then you become the best junior in the country. And if you're the best junior in the country, you're ready to then go and play in the intermediate pro-am events. And then you become, you know, and then you kind of get, you kind of like, you need that sort of competition week in, week out, to develop as a player, you know, and learn your trade. Now there isn't that competition about, you know, grassroots, you know, I'm talking about grassroots level now, I'm not talking about professional snooker. And I just think there should be more of a grassroots setup in place. And even amongst the professional level, where there's a tiered system or there's like a divisions where players are competitive at the moment. You know, a lot of these players come in and they draw a Judd Trump first round, they get beat 4-0, they might have put one red and one black. I mean, what have they learned from that? You know, they haven't really learned much. All they've learned is that shit, you know, I hope I don't draw him again. So it's a massive confidence denter. And, you know, and I just don't think you're able to hold them long enough to go through that period where the conference is going to get dented. So they need a bit more level playing competition, and the fittest will survive and they'll come through that division, and then they'll be ready to just go up in levels. But there's no point sticking these players in against, you know, like a Mark Selby, because they're just going to get destroyed, and, you know, they're not going to learn much from it. And I don't think the top players get anything from it either. You know, there's no satisfaction in beating someone that you know you can beat very, very easily, you know. And the other thing is that these guys on their day might get a result, and what that does is it gives them false confidence, false hope. They've had a good day, but they're not. It's not about good days. It's about good weeks, good months, and good years, like I was saying before. So it's kind of like you want to sort of take that platform away from them in a way and go, right, you know, you're not moving up to this level until you've reached this level. And I just think, you know, that's probably the best way to do it. And that would encourage parents to hopefully get their son more involved in the sport, you know, from the start. Because, you know, you're up against other sports. Golf has fantastic grassroots, football, tennis have a lot of good academies and stuff like that. So, you know, when you've got a massive market out there, you know, you need to put yourself in the shop window and kind of try and attract these people away from tennis, golf and football and try and get them into playing snooker. And it's not easy to do, because a lot of these sports have really, you know, if you had a choice now between getting your son into snooker or football, you know, what would you choose? You'd probably choose football. Or if you didn't like football, you'd probably go golf or tennis, you know. And, you know, and if they didn't like that, then you go, oh, he likes pool. And you might end up taking him down a snooker, but it wouldn't be your first choice, if you know what I'm saying.
Is it something you might do, like, you know, you've sort of alluded to, like, retirement at some point in your career, although, you know, I think you said recently you might still be playing when you're 60.
Yeah.
But I was wondering if that's something that appeals to you, like mentoring younger players and things like that, would, like, giving a bit back to the sport.
There's not a lot I could really do for snooker because it's kind of like it's running a situation now where there's a few... The people that run the game, they're treating it like a business and they're just sucking everything they want to suck out of it and they're getting their wages out of it and the players have just gone, look, there's a few tournaments and they're all fighting over whatever they've got to do. And so it's very difficult to grow something and put things in place because unless it's a moneymaker, it's like, why am I, you know, why do they want to get involved in the grassroots? So there's not really much you can do with snooker in that way. Really, so it's, you're kind of like hands tied. If you can't have much of an impact on it, then what's the point of even trying to do it in the first place? So, listen, you know, at some point, you know, I would love to maybe help out with some players, whatever level they are. You know, my phone, you know, my door would always be open to any snooker player because I think if they've got the bottle or the willingness to pick that phone up and ask for help, then, you know, I would never say no to anybody. But while I'm playing that, obviously that wouldn't be possible. But when I stopped, I would love to sort of maybe pass on whatever there is I could pass on to a younger, new generation type player, yeah.
It goes back to that asking for help again, doesn't it? I think that's an important part of life and sport and career, to be honest. I'm wondering, you talked about sort of setbacks earlier and, like, you know, young players having knockbacks and stuff. Obviously, you've, you know, in your personal life, had at a young age, quite a lot of knockbacks with, you know, your dad going to prison and stuff like that. Did snooker become sort of an escape from that, I guess? Because you were looking after your sister or something, weren't you? And then obviously you got snooker at the same time. Was snooker sort of helpful in those times?
Yeah, it was. It was, exactly. You know, like, obviously my dad was away. That was a knock. That was a big knock. And then my mum went away, another knock. But deep down, you know, I had this career that I had and, you know, and a love for the sport. And like I said, you know, I'd go down the snooker club and, you know, whatever was going on, you kind of like, your mates would sort of snap you out of it, or a game of Clukey, you'd kind of like lose yourself in certain things, you know.
Get on Clukey.
Yeah, and they kind of like, that was my church, you know, so whatever shit I had going on in my life, I could always just dump it at the door at Ilford and go, you know what, pie, chips and peas, game of Clukey, best of nine, get home, I've got through a day, do you know what I mean? And yeah, like, you know, when that time when I had to look after my sister, you know, or try to look after her, you know, I was going through a really bit of a bad spell myself, you know, so I probably wasn't the most sensible person to do. But you just do your best, you know, your mum and dad's both in prison, you do your best. So, and I've quickly realised that me looking after my sister probably wasn't the best thing. So we had a family friend that lived around the corner and they looked after my sister and that was the right thing to do. But yeah, you just kind of, I think you just get through situations. You realise what you can and can't take on. I'd always try and do my best in whatever situation, but if I'm not good enough at it, I'd always say that, you know, I need a bit of help here, like you say, you know, pick that phone up. And there's a support network out there, family and friends that have been there. And that's still to this day. And that's why, you know, it's good to have good friends and a good circle of people that you can rely on and trust, you know.
Absolutely. And I think as well, people, you know, it's so interesting you're saying going down, leaving it all at the door of the snooker club. I think people underestimate, people that aren't into sport, whatever sport it is. And I come from a footballing family. Me and my brother play football and have done for a long time. I think people underestimate how helpful sport can be when you're going through a tough time, whether it's playing with teammates or playing individually or, you know, going down and meeting people at the snooker club or whatever. Sport for me, and this is why I've got an 11-month-old daughter, and I'm desperate for her to get into sport in some way. I want her to play for England ladies, obviously, but that, you know, might not happen. Although I'm thinking about putting a bet on that at some point, because I'm sure I'll get really good odds on that. But I want her to get into sport because it helped me so much as a kid, you know, and I think people just underestimate how helpful sport can be for anyone, whatever their background, whatever their story, whatever they're going through.
I love it. I mean, my son, he plays football and I see the joy and, you know, he's happy, you know, he's kicking the ball around, he's with his teammates. And I just think, you know, it's so nice for him to have that outlet. I see him go to school and I see him, you know, got their exams and they've got this and they've got that. And I just think, when I see them on a football pitch, I think, yeah, that's, you know, just to be able to have that release, if you like. And then my daughter as well, she's into a horse riding, and she goes on these competitions, and I see her down the stables and I see her riding a horse. And I just think she's like, that's the happiest she ever, you don't see her any more happy than when she's on a horse or mucking out of a stable, you know. And I just think, yeah, it's great that, you know, that they've got sport in their life, and you want them to keep that going, you know, even when they come like finish school or whatever. It's just so great to have that, you know, to be able to go and play tennis with your friend or go and play football and have that sort of outlet. You know, it's a time for us just to sort of, like you say, leave everything at the door and just have a laugh, you know, and enjoy it, and you know, just keep fit as well and make yourself feel better.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ronnie, it's been an absolute privilege to chat to you today, and thank you so much for giving us your time. Before we go, we normally ask our guests for a little bit of advice on, because obviously the podcast is Blank Moments, and obviously that sort of alludes to sort of those difficult moments. Yeah. And if you've got any advice for anyone who's having a difficult moment at the moment or a blank moment, and how they might get through that period in their lives.
I always like to think it's good to sort of step away from whatever it is, you know, like whatever situation is you're finding difficult or stressful. Sometimes it's good to step away, surround yourself with good friends, good people, eat good food, and nurse yourself back to feeling, you know, good again, you know, and then go back to what it was that was sort of, you know, which you were struggling with. So a lot of the time that had been me with snooker. So leading up to tournament, you know, rather than keep practicing, I'd go for a run, I'd eat good food, I'd surround myself with very, very good friends that had good energy. And then a week later, boom, it's like I've had this, you know, it's like I've been nourished in a way. And, you know, you like I said, we need to be in peak condition. And sometimes to find the right answer, you have to step away from it, take a breather. You know, I'm not going to become a bad snooker player in 1 week. I'm not going to become a bad runner in 1 week. I'm not, you know, sometimes you just need that sort of, to get out of the, like what Steve says, get out of the treacle. Step out of the treacle, get away, find some, you know, happiness in your life, lighten up a little bit, come back strong with a new energy, and boff, there you go. And I always believe the right answer comes in that sort of process. So probably not the words of wisdom of the.
It's brilliant.
But it's just sometimes how I kind of approach certain situations, and you know, you can just adopt it to any situation, really.
Or play a game of Kaluki.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Go and have a game of Kaluki with the lads.
I definitely want to learn how to play Kaluki.
I'll teach you.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, please, man. I would love that. Cheers, well, Ronnie, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate your time. It's been fantastic talking to you. And,
thank you for having me on. It was good. Good to talk to you both. Really good.
There you go. That was Ronnie O'Sullivan on the Blank Podcast.
What a great man.
What a great episode.
Great episode. There's so much great advice in there. And as you say, such an honest person. But you know, often when you talk about sports, people being honest, it's, you know, I think people equate that to being a bit controversial. But actually, as you say, he's just also really nice. So he's just, you know, talking as it is, really. And I found it really fascinating. It's always fascinating to talk to someone who's been at the top of their game, even for a little bit, but for someone that's been top of their game for so long. But to hear him talk about that, even, you know, even though he's been the best snooker player in the world for so long, 30 years, he still has his doubts, and he still has his days and his matches where he doesn't feel on it, and he has his little techniques working through it. And you think, blimey, this guy's been the best for 3 decades, and even he doesn't believe in himself sometimes. So, I'm going to do fine, really. So, almost quite comforting, that, in a way.
Absolutely. And yeah, and it was really good. He was open about working with Steve Peters, the psychiatrist, and how much that has helped his game as well. And particularly the last tournament that he won.
Yeah.
That was huge. Had a huge impact on him. And, you know, although we sort of talked about it a little bit, but I think, you know, fairly unique within the sport doing that. And I think, you know, we've seen it in other sports using psychologists, sports psychologists, and being very effective. And I think, you know, for Ronnie, it's really helped him hone his game and actually really focus on in those moments that he needs to focus.
Absolutely, yeah. I think he's obviously the sort of person that his legacy, I think, and his influence on the game will be felt for years to come, whether it is him lighting a fire under younger people with his recent comments, whether it is more snooker players using psychologists, whether it is just snooker players who watched him growing up, who are now coming into the game, who want to play in that explosive, entertaining way that he has done for so long. I think his legacy is going to be absolutely massive in snooker.
Oh, huge, huge, yeah. Yes. Yeah. So thank you, Ronnie. That was great. I've got a couple of I've got a tweet here.
Yep, good idea. I will research one while you do that. But
I've got one here from Lou Peter, and her comment is, if you're running out of podcasts to listen to, y'all should check out Blank Podcast with Giles Pro Phillips and Jim Daly. They have some great guests, and you can listen on Spotify, Acast, and iTunes. So that's a very nice endorsement.
So first of all, Lou Peter, great name, and she should get a job on Blue Peter, because that's just
definitely.
Also, I'm going to assume that she is from the States, possibly a southern state of some sort.
I'm surmising that too.
And I'm going to read a tweet out here. I think we've read a tweet out from this guy before, Mr. Adam Murphy, who sent us a series of tweets, because he's a huge fan, isn't he? He's a super fan.
Well, he's going through the back catalogue, which is really nice, because it keeps popping up with, and he's listened to, you know, whoever it might be from the back catalogue. And I'm thinking, my God, and I'm just remembering all these amazing people we've talked to. So it's really nice, actually. So keep those coming, Adam, because it's really lovely to see those popping up on the timeline and thinking, all these amazing people we've talked to.
We asked people to go through the back catalogue, and that's exactly what he's done. And as you say, it's such a nice little refresher. And today's actually is he's listened to the Rufus Sewell episode.
Oh yes, yeah,
which was a great one. That was such fantastic. A fun one. What a great guy Rufus is. And Adam's put, really like hearing the laughter in this episode. We did laugh a lot in this one. I want Rufus Sewell to be in more upcoming projects. I'd love to see him as a Bond villain.
Oh,
that's a great
show. He would be a great guy, because he's a villain in Man in the High Castle. He does play good villains, actually. He's villain in one of the Zorro movies as well, if I remember correctly. So he does. He is good at villains.
And I think we talked about that in the episode.
But he's not a villain in real life. He's a very, very lovely man.
A really nice guy. We're so lucky in this pod. Everyone that comes on, you know, no matter what you might have seen or heard about them before, ends up being really nice people.
Yeah, so we are so lucky.
We appreciate that. So thank you, Adam, for that tweet. Much appreciated. And of course, if you'd like to tweet us, if you're going through the back catalogue or, you know, any episodes really resonate with you, you can tweet us. Our handle is
@blankpod.
And we're also on Facebook and Instagram as well, which is the same handle.
It is @blankpod.
And you can email us as well, although at this point I don't know why we're still giving the email address out, because no one ever sends us any. But if you do fancy a bit of a longer chat, we're always there on email, and our email address is
theblankpodcast2018@gmail.com.
There you go. And we've just was it the other day, or was it last week's pod where we talked about, it was 2 years since we met up to talk about doing the podcast?
Yes, it's the anniversary this week, which is amazing. Yeah, 2 years we've been doing this.
Crazy.
And still no one's emailed us.
Well, maybe another 2 years you might get an email of sorts. But anyway, I think that's probably time to wrap up this week. So thank you so much to Ronnie for being just a wonderful, wonderful guest.
Yeah, it was a brilliant, brilliant episode, and I hope you enjoyed it. And we'll see you again next week for another great episode.
We will indeed. Take care, and we'll see you again soon on the Blank Podcast.